It's 6 after 10 on Monday, May 25th, Memorial Day. Good morning and happy Memorial Day. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. This hour, we're going to hear a story about how a woman turned a death sentence into one of the most remarkable achievements of the last century. The book is titled Life Story, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds, and was written by Olivia Gentile, an award-winning journalist who tells the life story of Phoebe Snetsinger, perhaps the best-known birder of all time. Olivia Gentile is with me on the telephone this morning. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Thanks for spending part of your Memorial Day with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be on, and I'm really excited to come to Milwaukee.
Well, let's talk about that before I forget, which I probably will, even though I have a great big note in front of me, not to forget. You're going to be in Milwaukee reading from your book on June 6th at 2 o'clock?
June 6th, 2 o'clock at the Boswell Book Company, which is the former Schwartz's on Downer Avenue.
Okay, well, I'm sure
North
that
North Downer Avenue, I guess.
It's 2559 North Downer Avenue, according to my notes.
Right.
And I'm counting on my producers to put a note up on my screen to mention this again before we let you go at the end of the hour.
Okay.
Because we want to let people know where they can come and see you. Well, for birders or bird watchers, Phoebe Snetsinger is as well known as Alex Rodriguez would be to baseball fans or Brett Favre for footballers, but. And her life has been written about in journals and at least one biography other than yours that I know of. But it's safe to say that outside the birding community, she's probably not so well known. How did you come to choose this person as a subject for a book?
Well, I'd like to add that this is the first biography that's been written of her. She did write a memoir.
Oh, that's right. Okay.
And that focused really on her birding trips. More than on, you know, her entire life. So my book, Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds, begins, you know, with her childhood, which was a very interesting childhood in Chicago, and takes you all the way through her death in 1999. And I decided to write this book because I was actually looking for a bird watcher to write about. I was not a bird watcher. Now I am a casual bird watcher. I was a journalist, and I had dated a bird watcher very seriously. And at the time, I thought, you know, his bird watching was kind of a weird habit. I didn't really get it. And then I realized that he was clinically depressed and that birding was the one thing that kind of kept him going. And once I realized that, I was intrigued, and I started poking around for a bird watcher to write about. By this time, I had broken up with him and was living in New York City, and a member of the Long Island Bird Club misunderstood my inquiry and thought I was looking to join the club. And he said, who knows, maybe you'll be the next Phoebe Snetsinger.
Was that the first you had heard of her?
Yes, that was the first I'd heard of her, so I asked, who was that? And he explained a couple of things. I think he said that she saw more bird species than anyone in history and that she had had cancer. And he told me a couple other details, which I won't give away to our listeners. And I looked her up. There was an obituary in the New York Times that had run. And I called her husband in St. Louis. And a couple weeks later, I was interviewing him at his home.
Well, and I don't want you to give away all the details of the book. We certainly understand that.
Oh, but I'll give away more than I just did.
Well, we only have an hour, so. Give us a little bit. You talked a little bit about Phoebe's background growing up. She had an interesting childhood in Chicago. She came, as I understand it, she came from a family of some means. I mean, she had a comfortable upbringing, certainly, and sounds like she went to all the right schools.
Yes, her father was Leo Burnett, the Chicago advertising magnate. He was a real obsessive genius, and she inherited his intelligence and his drive and his penchant for obsession. And the problem was she came of age during an era when women were just supposed to be housewives. And she had wanted to be a scientist, and she went to Swarthmore and pursued science in the honors program there, but she ended up a housewife with four kids, by age 34.
And this would have been in the 1950s?
Yes, and she got married in 1953. By 1964, she had four kids, and she was kind of going crazy. She loved her kids. She loved her husband, but she wanted more out of life. And that's when she discovered birds. A friend introduced her to bird watching, and from then on, it was her passion. But then when she was 49, she was diagnosed with melanoma and told she had less than a year to live. And that's when she decided to start traveling. And she wanted to see as many bird species as she could in the short time she had left. But she didn't end up getting sick as predicted. And she ended up traveling the world for 18 more years, very adventurously, and seeing more species than anyone in history.
Well, let's talk about when she got this diagnosis. Now, as I understand it, that was, what, 1981?
Yes.
She received the diagnosis, and then she went on a birding, well, she went on a trip to Alaska, didn't she? And it seems to me that when she came back, she was in remission. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, what happened was she was told that the melanoma had advanced to her lymph nodes by the time it was caught. And the doctors perhaps should not have been so categorical about this, but they did tell her that she most likely had less than a year to live based on, you know, where the lymph nodes that were affected. And she already had this trip to Alaska planned, and her kids were in college and late high school, and she said, you know, what the hell, I'm going to take it. And she even thought she might die in Alaska. But she was good friends with the tour guide who was leading the trip. She had met him on a previous trip somewhere in Arizona, and he encouraged her to come, and she found that while she was in Alaska, she wasn't dwelling on her diagnosis as she had been, you know, all spring. She was able to experience as much joy in the field as she always had. And so she came back and she said, you know, I still feel fine. You know, she hadn't experienced any symptoms of her cancer, and there was no good treatment at the time. There still are very limited treatment options for melanoma. And so she said, I'm going to take some more trips. So she signed up for a trip to Australia, and she spent the summer studying for it, learning all the birds of Australia. And then she had a wonderful time there, and then she started planning additional trips. And it just built and built until she was traveling 9 months out of every year.
Let's back up a second, because I want to make sure that we really place this in the proper context, because mm-hmm. you talked about you know, by 1964 she had four children and a husband. Her husband was a scientist.
Yeah, he was actually a poultry scientist, which meant that he studied poultry nutrition and helped design poultry feed for Purina, and he eventually became a high-level executive at Purina. But his background was in poultry nutrition.
Okay, so Phoebe Snetzinger had a science background herself. She studied it in college and really wanted to pursue that. She married a scientist. She had four children, and but was very unhappy and really was, like, probably, according to the literature, a lot of women of her generation who wanted to do something else but felt that they couldn't. And
right.
So here's this very unhappy person. She discovers birding, and then she gets this cancer diagnosis. I mean, that must have just seemed like a real slap in the face.
Yeah, you know, there was about a little more than a decade between the time she discovered birding and the time she got her diagnosis. But what was a real slap in the face was that when she got her diagnosis, her kids were finally nearly grown. So she had been a very devoted mother for 20 years, and she was ready to start living more for herself.
Well, I guess that's what I was kind of aiming at,
right?
That, because, you know, here's now, she's got this chance. Okay, the kids are grown. They don't need as much from me. And now I can go out and do something for myself. And next I see the doctor, and he tells me I've got a year to live.
I know.
Her response to that, to me, is the most remarkable thing about the whole story.
Uh-huh. That she was just going to live her life to the fullest for as long as she could. Is that what you're
Yeah, she made the decision that, by golly, I don't care about this. I'm going to go do this for myself, and I'm going to make this happen. And, you know, I mean, she lived 18 more years with this diagnosis hanging over her head and died in a car accident. I mean, you know, this is just such an incredibly remarkable story. I'm so amazed. I've never heard of this person before.
Well, she was an incredible woman, and the events of her life, you know, would be almost unbelievable in a work of fiction. You know, she endured so many hardships while traveling. She was gang raped at one point in Papua New Guinea, and nearly murdered, but she and her friend managed to escape. And she just continued birding. And birding at first was a source of just pure unadulterated joy for her. It kept her mind off her cancer. It enabled her to lose some of her shyness and really make a lot of friends because, you know, birding is a social activity. But as time went on, and especially after she was raped, she did become very obsessive and very concerned with being the first person to see 8,000 bird species. And so her passion became darker as time went on and more focused on, you know, winning this game than on just seeing all the wonderful birds that she could. And so it's sort of an interesting life lesson for all of us that maybe when we start focusing more on winning and less on the intrinsic joy of our hobby or our profession, we lose something.
We are just about at a break, and I want to give people a chance to join in on this topic. I'm certain that there will be a lot of people out there who already know who Phoebe Snetsinger was and the significance of her life. Maybe you're a birder. We'll call up, and maybe you've got a story to tell of your own about how you got involved in birding and what it means to you to go out and observe these creatures in the wild and identify them. Talk about that a little bit. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. The title of the book is Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. Olivia Gentile is the author, and she's with us for the rest of this hour. Your chance to talk to her and ask her questions about an amazing woman, Phoebe Snetsinger, right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Kathleen will be back tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 20 after 10. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. After 4 today, join Ben Marins and his guest in a conversation about creating a sense of wholeness and personal satisfaction in your life, whether you are on your own or in a relationship. That is after 4 at Issue with Ben Marins this afternoon. The issue this hour is a new book about the life of Phoebe Snetsinger. The author is Olivia Gentile. She's with me by phone. The title of the book is Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. One thing I wanted to ask you, Olivia, was about the title, Life List. Where did that come from?
Well, birders keep life lists, and what that means is it's a list of all the birds they've seen and identified in the field over the course of their birding careers. And when you every time you see a new species and you manage to identify it, it's called a life bird, and you add it to your life list.
Okay, so is there some kind of this is going to be another one of my famous stupid questions, but is there some competition to see who can get the biggest life list?
Yes. You know, some birders don't participate in the competition, and others do. But most birders keep a life list, and then a few birders try to see more species than you know their compatriots. Some birders focus on these competitions called big days, where they try to see as many species as they can in 24 hours. And other birders focus on big years, seeing as many species as they can in a year. But Phoebe was focused on seeing as many bird species as possible over the course of her life. And I also liked the metaphorical implications of Life List as a title.
Well, you know, I mean, most of us assume that we're going to be around for, you know, a number of years hence. And you know, we aren't we don't walk around, most of us. I'm not going to say everybody. But, I mean, most of us don't walk around assuming that, you know, well, I'm going to die tomorrow afternoon. But here's a woman who had no idea. I mean, she had this illness. I mean, it was a fact. It was true. She had melanoma and she had no idea how much time she really had left. The doctors had given her a year. And so she must have lived in a state of almost constant grace for her and didn't know how many birds she could get to. So that really led some urgency to her quest.
She believed them. She didn't think, oh, I'm going to beat this cancer. She thought, I'm going to die and I'm going to make the most of the time I have left. And ironically, she was never happier than during the several years right after her diagnosis. I remember she wrote to a friend about a year after the diagnosis about all the travels she'd taken, and she said, I know the balloon will burst sometime in the next couple of years, but meanwhile, life is so good. And I just think it's so beautiful that she was able to turn the diagnosis into a vehicle for self-transformation.
Well, I hate to keep making you back up like this and cover old ground, but discovering things about my notes that I didn't notice yesterday when I was trying to do prep for this. Phoebe Snetsinger went on a safari to Kenya with her husband, and this is before she actually got her cancer diagnosis, I think,
if I get
the chronology right. But talk about her discoveries there and what that meant for her.
Well, she had been birding already for about a decade, mostly in the Midwest. She was originally from Chicago, but lived outside St. Louis. And she had built up a life list of 500 species over a decade. Now, in Kenya, which is one of the birdiest places on Earth, she managed to see 500 species in just 3 weeks. So she doubled her life list in 3 weeks. And that experience was staggering for her. Another thing about Kenya is the birds are actually quite easy to see in Kenya because they're not hidden in trees, or they don't tend to be. They tend to be out on the savanna or, you know, in the sparse trees on the savanna. Whereas in some of the other really birdy countries like Peru or Ecuador, the birds are very much hidden in the rainforest. So it's a great place for people to go on their first tropical birding trip. And I actually went to Kenya to see some of what she saw. And even though I'm not a serious birder, it was amazing. And you really can behold the birds without being very skilled because they are out in the open. And you also see amazing mammals.
Well, you used the term staggering. It must have been all of that. I mean, if she had seen up till that point, her life list was 500 birds, and she'd been doing it for a number of years, and then all of a sudden to go to Kenya and double it in 3 weeks, that had to just be just an absolutely incredible experience.
It really awakened her to what was possible if she started taking trips to the tropics, because her kids were getting to be independent by that point. Some of them were already in college and two of them were still in high school. She really started to fantasize about what kind of life she could lead once they were all in college. And she started to think about going, she did actually go to Brazil and Ecuador before her diagnosis and also Panama on kind of casual birding tours. Birding tours, by the way, were a new phenomenon at the time. Now there's a ton of bird tour companies, but at the time, birding was just beginning to kind of go global. And she envisioned a future in which she took maybe one or two wonderful tropical birding trips a year for the rest of her life. But then when she got her diagnosis, obviously she decided that wasn't going to be enough because her life was going to be so short.
We have a caller on the line who wants to ask a question, so let's take the call right now. John in Milwaukee, good morning.
Yes, lots of things here, but I was wondering some of the more unique species are up in the higher altitudes in Nepal and the Himalayas, and I was wondering if she got there. I was wondering what her most unusual bird was that she saw, and then what her favorite bird was.
Okay, those are great questions. She did go to the Himalayas a couple of times. The first time she went up to about 13,000 feet, and the second time she went up to about 17,000 feet. And by that time, she was in her mid-60s. So her trips actually became more rigorous as she got older, because she was looking for the higher altitude birds or the more remote birds that she had missed on her first trips to various places. In terms of the rarest bird, well, you know, one bird she saw, which at the time was extremely rare, was the kagu, which is in New Caledonia, and it had nearly gone extinct in the 1970s, and she was one of the first people to see it in the 80s when it started to come back. At this point, a lot of people have seen a kagu, but Phoebe was thrilled to be one of the first people to
what
see
kind,
one.
What kind of bird is the kagu?
The kagu is kind of a chicken-like bird. I actually have an illustration of it in the book, done by a wonderful artist in Austin named Rebecca Layton. But it's kind of a gray chicken-like bird that yelps like a puppy, and it has this funny gray crest and red eyes. And it had been nearly eradicated by all the introduced dogs and rats on the island of New Caledonia. But then a park ranger almost single-handedly managed to save the species, and now it's very much on the rebound. And in terms of her favorite bird, she pretty much changed her favorite bird every, you know, depending on what she was looking for. Whatever bird she was looking for at that moment was her favorite bird. Maybe for every trip she took, she would have one or two birds that she was really dying to see, and those would be her favorite birds. And then she would see them or maybe not see them, but then seek out new birds on the next trip, and those would be her favorite birds.
John, thanks for calling. Do you have anything else you'd like to ask, as long as you're on the phone?
No, I think that the birds up in the Himalayas are the ones that most birders, when they get into the hobby, it's the ones that they train for.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, you get both the experience of the mountains and the birds itself. So I think that's the height of the hobby.
Yes, and she by the time she did make it up to 17,000 feet, she had to train a lot for that. As I said, she was getting up in age, and it was a very difficult trip for her, but she succeeded. She also took some trips into the highlands of China, which were very difficult.
John, just to ask, are you a birder? No, I think we lost him. I'm going to assume he is based on the questions. Boy, 17,000 feet. I mean, that's 3 miles above sea level. Air's got to be pretty thin there.
Yeah, I think she wrote in her notes that every step was a struggle. And she was birding at that point with, you know, people who were 40 years her junior, a lot of long-legged European men who were in their 20s and 30s. And she could keep up with them.
So how did her disease progress during this time when she was doing all this globe-trotting and birding? She was going into some very hostile environments. How was her disease progressing at this point?
Well, her cancer never actually made her feel sick, but it did recur in her lymph nodes several times. And every time she would go in and have surgery and find out if there were new treatments, which there weren't, and then go back to her life. Now, at one point, she actually found a lump in her armpit. She diagnosed it correctly as a recurrence of the melanoma. This was in 1990. But she had a trip planned for the next day to Australia and New Guinea for 7 weeks, and she decided, you know what, I'm just going to go on this trip, and I'm going to have the surgery for the melanoma recurrence when I get back, because I don't want to risk missing this trip, which I'm really looking forward to. So she took the trip, and when she got back, she got her surgery, and again, the doctors said, well, it's likely to spread now to your other organs, and you probably don't have very long to live. But she She had been told that for years by this point.
Well, yeah, that had to kind of sound like a crying wolf, you know. I mean, you know, yeah, okay, you keep saying that, and it keeps not happening, so.
And by this point, you know, she believed them with part of her mind, and with the other part of her mind, she wasn't willing to believe them and just wanted to keep planning her trips and keep taking her, you know, these wonderful bird tours that were introducing her to species that she'd only dreamed of before she got sick, and also to many, many new friends.
We have phone lines available for you if you want to call in and join our discussion about Phoebe Snetsinger and with the author of a new book about the life of Phoebe Snetsinger, Olivia Gentile, who is the author of Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. Here's the number to call to join our discussion, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would prefer to use email, you can do that too. We're really up to date here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's the address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Or call us at 800-486-8655. If you have a question about the life of Phoebe Snetsinger, maybe, well, gosh, you know what? I wonder if there's anybody in our audience who actually got to meet her or was had some connection to her during her life as a birder. That might be kind of interesting to hear about. By the way, Olivia Gentile will be in Milwaukee coming up on June 6th at Boswell Book Company, formerly Schwartz's. That's on Downer Avenue, 2559 Downer Avenue, at 2 o'clock, June 6th. She'll be there. She'll be reading some selections from her book and be there for you to talk to as well. But you can talk to her by phone today if you join us at 800-486-8655 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You mentioned some of the kind of harrowing experiences that Phoebe Snetsinger had in her pursuit of these birds, and it just seems like some of this stuff it would make the I don't want to say the normal person, I'll say the average person go, you know what, the heck with this, you know, I'm gonna start collecting baseball cards because this is just too much. I mean, a gang rape, for goodness sakes, that's just horrible.
Right. But Phoebe, after she was raped, she only became more passionate and more intense about seeing birds. And in fact, I argue in the book that it was a major emotional turning point for her because she was so determined to show everyone that the rape had not affected her. And so determined not to go into counseling and not to talk about it in detail with her husband and so on and so forth, that I think it really shut her off from other people in her life, from her family and some of her friends in a lot of ways, and made her all the more committed to her birding career. And it wasn't long after she was raped that she and her husband really started to grow apart. They had been growing apart for a while, but they grew apart even more in the late 80s and early 90s. He was winding down his career and getting ready to retire, and she was just ramping up and taking more and more trips to more crazy places. And she had set her sights on, you know, seeing more species than anyone in history. In 1993, he confronted her and said that he wanted a divorce.
Well, one of the things you deal with in your book is how her passion for birding, some might call it an obsession, affected her family, and it clearly affected her marriage. How did it affect her relationship with her children?
Well, you know, since she had four children, it affected each of them in different ways. The one son, Tom, he became a serious bird watcher. He didn't try to see more species than other people. He wasn't part of that competition, but some of his favorite memories from childhood are of standing on the roof of his house with his mother and watching the warblers come through their backyard. So she imparted to him a deep love of nature, and he is now a professional ornithologist. He studies spotted owls in Oregon. And so they really stayed very close. even as Phoebe was traveling, they would go birding together, sometimes in Hawaii, where he lived for a while, sometimes in the Pacific Northwest. And he understood her passion and didn't mind how much she was traveling. The three daughters, to differing extents, did mind. I would say the eldest daughter, Penny, who was already in college when she started traveling a lot, minded less than the two younger daughters who were still in high school when their mother started traveling quite a bit. And they never stopped loving her, and they you know, tried to see her as much as they could, but they were also resentful that she often put birding before them.
How did they feel about your book?
You know, each of them felt differently, I think. I worked very closely on the book with Tom, the son, and also with Dave, Phoebe's husband, and I interviewed each of them six times. I interviewed each of the daughters at least once. Some of the daughters preferred to be less involved with the book, but I think all of them appreciated the interest I showed in their mother's life, and I think they like the book as it turned out. I think that they think it's an even-handed and I think a sensitive portrayal of Phoebe. But on the other hand, the book does bring to light some of Phoebe's flaws, and I'm sure that's painful for them to read. And I'm sure reading about the troubles within their own family is painful. So I've really appreciated working with the family and how open they've been to me despite the attendant pain.
Now, you mentioned that her husband had confronted her for a divorce in 1993. Did they get one?
Well, no. She actually said that she still loved him. She said it wasn't fair because, you know, all those years that he'd been pursuing his career at Purina, she had been home with the kids and she had been unhappy, and now she was having her career, and he needed to support her in that. And, you know, on the one hand, she had a point, and on the other hand, you know, he wasn't traveling so much during his career. He was traveling some, but not 9 months out of the year. And so she made a deal with him. She said, once I get to 8,000 species, once I set that record, because no one had ever gotten to 8,000 species, I will slow down, and I will essentially retire from competitive birding, and we'll spend more time together. And she did get to 8,000 species, and she didn't really slow down.
We have a caller on the line, Mike, in Sauk City. Let's go to Mike next. Thanks for joining us. Happy Memorial Day.
Hello. How are you?
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I just wanted to call in. I knew Phoebe Smethinger just a little bit.
Oh, and, great.
I'm sorry?
I said, oh, great.
And I met her. One of my cousins was a neighbor of hers, and I met Phoebe through my cousin. And I also studied birds in Madagascar for a while, so I've ran into some of these other world-class birders. And to me, she was a little bit different than some of the other ones. And what I found was that she still had she wasn't just after the rare birds and just, you know, after the number. She had a genuine appreciation for birds and still was very interested and very knowledgeable about common birds in her own area. And to me, there was quite a contrast from what I observed with her versus some of the other birders that I ran into who were after the numbers.
She absolutely wanted to learn everything possible about every bird. She didn't just want to tick off birds on a list. And she loved seeing common birds. So that was one of her really great qualities. Now, I do think that there are more world birders are like that than a lot of people think. I mean, I met a lot of world birders who also were very interested in you know, much more than just their lists. But that is kind of a stereotype, I guess, of world birders that has some basis in the truth. And certainly Phoebe didn't like it when she encountered birders like that. she much preferred to spend her time with birders who had, you know, a passionate love of nature and love of knowledge.
Mike, thanks for the call. We're going to go to a break, and then when we come back, we've got some more callers who want to ask questions of our guest, Olivia Gentile, author of Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. It's the story of the life of Phoebe Snetsinger, and we're finding out all kinds of interesting things about this remarkable woman this hour here on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be right back. It's 10:43. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. Well, if you like to talk about birds, stick around, because Jim Packard will be continuing that theme when he talks with a pair of veteran bird watchers about neotropical migration of birds through Wisconsin. That's coming up after 11 this morning here on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is Olivia Gentile, author of Life List, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. Olivia, perhaps you can talk a little bit about what's the difference between a birder and someone who enjoys birds and feeds them, perhaps watches the ones that come in and you know, observes the birds in their yard. But maybe if they're real extreme, they bought a copy of Peterson's Field Guide to the Birds, but that's about it. They don't necessarily own even own a pair of binoculars. What's the difference between that that kind of bird watcher, as we like to think of it, and someone who's really a birder?
Well, you know, it's not a difference in quality, just a difference in degree. I mean, I consider myself more what you were just describing. I enjoy watching birds at my feeder, and I enjoy seeing birds when I happen to be out walking, but I don't really go out in search of them. But I think when I do see them, and they do, when I do see them, they affect me in much the same way that they affected Phoebe. They uplift me. They take me outside of myself. They blow me away. And so the difference is that Phoebe was just much more deliberate in her quest for birds, and she, you know, instead of just waiting to have the birds come to her, she would go out to the ends of the earth in search of them. And then there's a lot of people in between where I am and where Phoebe was. There's a lot of people who will go out to their local parks or maybe all around their state looking for birds, but they wouldn't go, you know, on a plane to look for birds. Then there's other people who would go on a plane to California, but not to Madagascar.
Well, is there a point at which this becomes more than a hobby and it starts to become, oh, I don't know, what's the word I'm looking for, religion?
Yes, and I talk about that in the book. I liken birding to a religion because much as religious people find community in their churches or temples, birders find community in their bird clubs. And the various birding societies that exist around the country. And much as religious folks will, go to mass or temple seeking peace and maybe some transcendence, birders go out into the field seeking peace and transcendence. So there are some similarities. And much as religion has its more passionate adherence and its more casual adherence, birding has both passionate and casual adherence.
We have another caller on the line. Brittany in La Crosse wants to join us next, and I think we should let her. Brittany, welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I was just wondering what in particular was so fascinating to Phoebe that made her so passionate to go out and seek all this information about these birds and to see as many as she could.
Right. That's a great question. And that's actually the fundamental question underlying the whole book. I mean, what possibly could have made her go to all these extremes? So I don't feel like I can answer it well in just a sentence, but I'll try. When she saw her first bird, it was a black Bernian warbler. It's this black and white warbler with a fiery orange throat. She said it was like she had seen a blinding white light. Or it was like a window opened up, and suddenly she had a window onto the natural world and all its beauty. So like I was just saying about birding and religion, she felt transcendent, So it was almost like birding lifted her to a higher plane of existence. It lifted her above the everyday. It made her feel like she was experiencing life in a deeper, richer way.
Brittany, thanks for that call. The stereotype that many of us have of bird watchers or birders, little old ladies in tennis shoes and maybe a funny hat or something, binoculars around the neck and a guidebook in front of them. I guess I've made that stereotype just ridiculous enough that it's obviously not true, but that's really not an accurate stereotype at all, is it?
Well, you know, Phoebe had her tennis shoes and she had her binoculars, she had her funny hat and her bird guide, but there was so much more to it. You know, she was also an adventuress and she was this passionate amateur scientist so it's not that it's not true, it's just that it's not complete.
Well, talk about some of those other adventures. I mean, we've touched on a few. She went to the Himalayas. She nearly lost her life on a couple of occasions. She seemed to be completely fearless about where she went. But talk about some of the other adventures. Tell us another story from your book in terms of one of the adventures that she had while she was seeking this record number of birds that she was going to have on her life list.
Well, two come to mind, and I'll mention both of them very briefly. One was that she got caught in the middle of a tribal war in New Guinea. This was a different time, different trip from the one where she got gang raped, but which was also in New Guinea. But her van actually was right in the middle of two warring tribes, and they were throwing spears and rocks at each other, but they were hitting the van because the van was caught right in the middle. Luckily, they managed to escape. Another adventure she had was in the Philippines, where she was searching after some very rare high-altitude birds, and she slipped and fell and broke her wrist in three places. However, she managed to convince herself that it was just sprained because she really wanted to continue with the trip. This was toward the end of her life. She didn't anticipate returning to the Philippines, and she really wanted to see these birds. So she drank some beer and took some aspirin and put it in a bandana, put the wrist in a bandana, and talked her guide into believing that the wrist was just sprained. And she continued on this very rugged trip in the Philippines for two more weeks with a broken wrist. And as a result, she experienced permanent nerve and dexterity damage.
Wow.
To her wrist. Her handwriting was never the same. She never regained full range of motion in her wrist. But this actually happened shortly before she died.
Hmm. And what you said, there were two stories. What was the other one?
Oh, the tribal war in New Guinea and the Philippines.
I'm too busy making notes. I'm not always able to listen the way I should. Let's see. Mark in Milwaukee is next. Mark, good morning.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to flesh out a little bit about this woman's life as an example from a psychological level. This was an example of a woman who changed her life totally due to a traumatic event where she more or less compartmentalized her life into birding, whereas before she was a dedicated researcher. She was probably a little bit more dedicated to it than most, but after the event of the rape, that changed her life entirely. And
after the cancer was one event that changed her life, and then the rape was another.
Well, to such an extent that her family and her husband became secondary to her life. I mean, this is a foundational event in her life. And although we might say that while she was obsessed, she would say that it's just what she liked to do, which is a great example of. I mean, considering her accomplishments, I mean, this is not something that a person of ordinary interest would pursue in their lives. She accomplished so much, but she just thought that she was doing what she liked to do. What she had done was completely compartmentalized that rape in her life and focused totally obsessively on birding. And I think it's a wonderful thing that she did. She certainly opened up the world for all of us. But that was the signature event in her life that changed everything.
Well, one of the things I like about Phoebe and her story is that different people have different reactions to her and different interpretations of her behavior. I mean, I try to be pretty even-handed and non-judgmental in the book and just tell the story as best I can. And I do think the rape was hugely significant. I also think the cancer was significant. I also think it was significant that she was the daughter of Leo Burnett, and she had this obsessive role model throughout her childhood. But she really wasn't able to pursue a career in the same way that her father had been able to. But I appreciate your interpretation, and I love hearing people's reactions. Some people really like Phoebe, and some people feel kind of ambivalent about her, and some people end up not liking her very much. And I think that's for me one of the really rewarding aspects of working on this.
And speaking of working on this, it took you 7 years to complete this book.
It did. You know, it was my first book, so I was learning how to write a book. But also, there was just a lot of research to do, a lot of interviews. Eventually, her family gave me access to her personal papers, her poetry, her journals, her letters. And that was just such a treasure trove for me. You know, I also had to figure out how I wanted to tell the story. I ultimately decided I wanted to tell it in a casual tone. I wanted, you know, casual, easy tone. I didn't want it to be a stiff academic tone. And I needed to learn about birds. I needed to learn about women's history. I needed to learn about the history of advertising. I needed to learn about the Midwest. I needed to learn about every place she had ever traveled to. So it was a wonderful experience, but it was a little bit overlong.
One of the things that's interesting about this, we look at Phoebe's life and we say, okay, so she was, you know, born in the 30s and she came of age and got married and had her children in the 50s and 60s and, you know, went through all this. Well, today it's different and women have a lot more opportunities, but they're really, that's sort of a yes and no thing, isn't it?
It is. And I don't talk about this in the book. I talk about it a little bit, on my website, but to me, this book has a lot of modern-day resonance, even though things are much, much better for women than they were during Phoebe's era. You know, women my age, I graduated from college in the 90s, and a lot of my friends have started their families and have children. And we're facing a lot of the same struggles that Phoebe was facing. Definitely we're allowed to have careers, and it's encouraged, but we're still supposed to do more than half of the childcare and the housework, and companies and the government still aren't really accommodating working parents. And I think that, unfortunately, not as much has changed as the women who were in the feminist movement in the 1970s had hoped would have changed by now.
Just to kind of put a cap on it here, Phoebe died in, what, 1999? She was in a car accident in Madagascar?
That's right, after all that.
It seems ironic somehow.
Yeah, you know, she was on her fourth trip to Madagascar. She was in search of the 10 or 20 birds she hadn't seen yet in Madagascar. And she was sitting in a certain position on the bus. She was sitting so as to elevate her ankle because she had just sprained her ankle the day before, and her back was to the van window, and she was asleep, and the van rolled over onto its side and her head took the impact, but no one else in the van was even seriously injured. She was the only one.
That's amazing. An amazing woman. Tell me, what was the most important thing that you learned that you took away from this whole experience of looking into the life of Phoebe Snetsinger?
Well, absolutely. It's the lesson to live every year as if it might be your last, because it might be. And then on a related note, to try to pursue your passions for their own sake and not for the sake of external recognition or for any sort of competitive goal, because once Phoebe started doing that, her joy was somewhat lessened.
And tell us again, you're going to be in Milwaukee on June 6th?
Yes, at the Boswell Book Company, the former Schwartz's on North Downer Avenue at 2 p.m.
And you have a website as well. May as well give us that.
Yes, it's www.oliviagentile, that's OliviaGentile.com.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, and good luck as you talk to people about this book and this remarkable woman.
Thank you so much for having me.
Olivia Gentile is the author of Lifeless, A Woman's Quest for the World's Most Amazing Birds. This program was ably produced by Rhonda Fanning, who always gets it right. On-air production today by John Treader. If you missed a portion of the program, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to it all over again. Or you can order a copy from the radio store by calling 800-747-7444 and ask for program 525E. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn today. Have a happy, happy Memorial Day.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.